I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music. With musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome to the show, Snacky Tunes, on here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Greg Bresnitz is on his way back from what seems like an amazing time in France. Cannot wait to hear all about it. Just a reminder, our July edition, super excited about, of the barbecue blowout happening tomorrow night at Good Company with Brad Spence and Mark Vetri. From Philadelphia, Jason Green will be on the decks. Heritage is going to be there. Food Republic will be there. Giving away a copy of the grilling book by Bon Appetit. Nikki Digital taking photos. Go to bbqblowoutjuly.eventbrite.com. Really excited. A lot of fun. See you there. As always, free to get in. $10 to eat. It's going to be a blast. But very excited today. Out-of-town guest. We met while he was one of the wonderful, insightful talking heads on Unique Eats on the Cooking Channel, produced and directed by the amazing Irene Wong. Mike Thielen, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you, Darren.
Welcome to New York. A little bit warmer than it is, I imagine, in Portland right now.
It's been a hot summer in Portland, but this weekend was crazy hot. I mean, crazy hot here in New York City.
This was one of those weekends where you go, okay, I know I've worked all week, and I know it's the weekend, and it's the summer, and I should be outside, but it's so hot.
And the type of weekend where people like me who come from the great northern woods of the Pacific Northwest, like, run to the nearest Uniqlo and buy a bunch of linen.
Bringing up Uniqlo, last winter was the first time I broke down when we had that really bad cold front, and I bought that thin, insulated, I forget what it was, but their heat tech type of stuff. It's amazing.
And it was like $70, cheap.
Cheap.
Yeah.
Cheap. And it was amazing, because it was one of those things like right after work, and it was just a line, and the only place that the people who was in the store was just in the heat tech section. People were just loaded up. Everyone broke. It was like the same day.
And I was here actually for that extreme spat of weather as well. Got stuck here for a couple days.
I remember.
Yeah. So.
Look, New York does really well when it's not an extreme weather condition. But I can actually probably deal more with the cold than I can with the heat in New York. There's something about the way the city bakes you a little bit.
It's true, but you have to agree with the fact that New York, especially Brooklyn, has an incredible patio culture.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, the reason why I don't leave New York or Brooklyn in the summer is because the summer culture in this town is amazing. It's really pitch perfect.
It's true. Lots of stuff to do. A lot of it doesn't cost a lot of money. I mean, look at us right now. We have a view of one of the most coveted patios in the entire world at Roberta's.
Yeah, then I don't know if you've been to one of their tiki disco parties on Sunday, but they're phenomenal.
I have not.
Legendary.
This patio makes me want a tiki disco.
Yeah. So, Mike, you are among many things. The co-founder of Feast Portland, mm-hmm. which is now in its second year.
Yep.
Coming up in September, which I, knock on wood, will be attending. I'm very excited about it. I haven't been to Portland since, I think I spent one night there when my brother was at school in Eugene.
Which is shocking for you because you seem to be everywhere.
I know. It's you know how it is? There's some restaurants or some books or some artists or some, like, that are on your list mm-hmm. of things you should go
sure.
or read or listen to. And some restaurants you're like, you got to go eat at. And for some reason or another, the best laid plans never happen.
No, it's true. I have a copy of David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest, that's been staring me down for about 10 years. I've used it to prop open my window. I've used it to kill bugs. It's quite a commitment. And, you know, for a New Yorker, a six-hour flight out to Portland, Oregon is also quite a commitment, too.
It is. You know, that book, I think, eventually sat in. It went from, like, shelf to storage to donation.
Well, it's like 100 pages long. I mean, you get through the first couple hundred pages, and you're like, oh, I'm getting into it. And you're like, had I been reading another author, I'd be done by now.
You know, my girlfriend in college gave it to me, and she was like, it's my favorite book. I've read it 3 or 4 times. And I was like, what?
Is that true, though? Has anyone actually finished that book?
I think people have finished it once. I think, like anything, I think have read the book, have gone to the tiny little cafe
sure.
that's, you know, 4 hours from anywhere, have, you know, went and found that one band play in a garage or barn somewhere. People make the effort. Now, if it's the effort to actually enjoy it versus saying that they've done the event, I don't know. But let's go back. Let's go back to Mike. How far back can we go in your life when you started thinking about food and bringing people together for events?
Well, I think pre-event, I mean, I come from a big family. My father had a previous marriage to my mother, and through that marriage, he had four daughters who are my sisters, you know, 20 years older than me. So they were almost like aunts in terms of the age range. But through their marriages, they had married into families from Mexico, into families from Vietnam, into families from Japan. So my upbringing was multiracial. And through that, I was you know, our family was like your family or anyone's family, big and crazy and full of drama. Every family's like that. But we'd come together over pretty epic spreads of food. And, you know, at a young age, I was exposed to a lot of interesting types of food and different cultures. And, you know, it just immediately as a kid, I really got it and identified with that. And, you know, I think my entire life I've really kind of seen the world through the lens of food. And you know, I judge cities by food. I like to hang out with people who like food. There's countries – I have a friend of mine who lives in a country which shall remain nameless, and I don't want to visit her because the food sucks. It's like, I love you, but can we meet in Mexico City?
I've definitely planned travels more and more around food, which is tough because – even some great big cities that I know that I need to go to before I can stop traveling as much as I can, I might not make it to because I said, okay, after the initial, like, oh, this is great local boiled potatoes and, or pierogies or like fried pork cutlet or something like that, which I'd love and I'll eat. But like after day four, you're like, oh, God, can I just.
Well, lived in Ireland for 6 months, so I can completely relate to you.
No good food culture in Ireland?
No, I mean, it's people say it's changed a lot, but, you know, it's not, you know, and again, Ireland has a lot of great things to offer. I mean, there's the great drinking culture, of course, and it's not just, you know, yes, there's a great club culture. Yes, I was there when I was 23, so to be fair, I wasn't probably looking for, you know, great food experiences that time in my life, but, you know, growing up, they had great whiskey. They had great beer. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, you get really used to. I mean, this whole organic, sustainable, local thing, we all grew up with. I mean, that's the thing about like Portland and Seattle and the West Coast is, you know, so it makes us laugh when people say, oh, Portland's almost over, or the Portland trend, or, you know, even in the beginning when people say, oh, Portland's so hot, they're doing this. It's like, we've always done that.
Right.
It's not a trend out there. It's real.
And it sounds like growing up with home-cooked meals and type of – and international ethnic sort of spread, I imagine that your take when people go, oh, look at this new cuisine, oh, look at this new thing, you go, yeah, I grew up eating that.
Well, I mean, yeah, but anything that brings people together over food, though, is awesome. And it's incredible that, you know, I would say the food culture, and I'm not sure if it's the cause or the effect, but in any case, it's like food culture is nothing more beautifully reflects our multicultural society than food.
Yeah.
You know, you can go to a city like Houston, Texas, which is big and diverse and sprawling. You're going to spend all day in a car. But when you get out, there's amazing food everywhere. Or, you know, it's not just Brooklyn or Manhattan or Boston or Seattle or Portland or Austin. It's like you go to Kansas City now and there's good food. It's kind of an everywhere thing. So that's pretty special.
Yes, in the cities. Between cities.
We still have a lot of work to do in the country.
And the thing is, though, what I've found is that it's not just in between American cities. It's in between a lot of cities, Europe, Asia, anywhere.
Totally.
You start going, there's not great food everywhere. But that's part of the journey of finding, like, okay, you know, who's making the pâté on the side of the road in middle of country France or serving, you know, tomato rub baguettes in Spain somewhere.
Yep.
What was your first food memory? Do you remember... Let me rephrase that. What was your first food memory of eating something where you go, this is not like other kids I'm hanging out with?
Okay, so my brother-in-law Gilbert's from Guadalajara, Mexico, and this was back in the late 80s, so I was, you know, 10 years old or something, and he would try to find goat meat, and this is before the internet. We could just go on online and order anything you want, dry ice, pay a little extra, it's there.
Right.
This is before there was like all the wild game purveyors locally. This is before there was halal butchers in Portland. Now there's quite a few, and then there was none. So he couldn't find goat meat. So his only thing that he could do was buy one live, reportedly once from a petting zoo, and like a place where you could go like buy goats as pets. He takes it home into his suburban garage, and he, like, you know, first the kids played with it for a few days,
of course,
and then, you know, he takes it in the garage, shuts the door, and a friend of mine has, you know, who lived across the street and grew up across the street from my brother-in-law Gilbert, was saying, yeah, there was like a stream of blood coming out of the garage because he had butchered it in the garage. And then he had this incredible recipe. He's from Jalisco, you know, Guadalajara, which is an incredible city, and there was this Jalisco dish. It was a slow roasted kind of pressure cooked goat, you know, and he couldn't find a pressure cook big enough either. So he would find, you know, those giant like stock pots that you used to like boil, you know, lobster in.
Yeah.
And he would like tie it up with, you know, all these different ropes and things and tape it down in order to make a pressure cooker out of it. It was totally jerry-rigged, this thing. But he would make this goat And the meat was so pungent, and it had all these different chilies, and it had cinnamon. And I remember eating this just thinking, this is like crazy. This is like making my head hurt. It's so interesting. And being, you know, 10 or 11 years old and just being, you know, transported to some faraway land. I mean, literally, because it food has the ability to do that. It mm-hmm. can just enter you into and immerse you in a culture even when you're not there.
And how long after that did it take you to find a dish that replicated that goat dish in your travels?
There's always those special dishes when you travel in certain places. You know, I think in Spain, I lived in Spain for a year, and I think what really was equivalent to that was the Iberian ham. Mm. You know, I mean, just what goes into it. You know, for those who don't know, it comes from a, you know, southern part of Spain in Andalusia. These pigs are free range. They grow up underneath the cork oak trees, and they eat nothing but the acorns their entire lives. So they fatten up slowly. You know, think of them as like paleo freaking, you know, they're like paleo pigs.
Yeah, those pigs are here about the paleo diet. Yeah. You'd be like, what are you talking about? Yeah, totally. It's what we do.
We eat nuts and...
Yeah.
So anyways, all they eat is that their entire life. So the meat is just gorgeously marbled, and it's like nutty, and you know, you literally are what you eat. And when they butcher this animal, I mean, the Iberian ham is just incredible. And you can get it in the States now, but you really can't get the best stuff in the States.
No. But it's funny because you mentioned there are so many things you can get on the internet.
Yeah.
But there is at some point where it's like, yeah, you can get a version of stuff on the internet, but to really get the best of the best in the world, you still somewhat have to go to the source, especially for food. Especially in America where there's all the FDA regulations or the taxes or whatever food politics are going on. Sometimes you just got to get on a plane and go to where they're making it.
Well, yeah, you can't. I mean, it's illegal to import a lot of that stuff. I mean, the reason why you don't see a full spectrum of Iberian ham production, from what I understand, there has to be a USDA inspector there in the facility in order for it to be imported. The other thing, you know, think of raw milk cheeses in places like France. You know, I mean, there's nothing like this stuff is incredible.
The closest you can get, you go up to Montreal.
It's true.
You go to Montreal and you get a lot of raw cheeses. And you can find raw cheeses in the States.
Yeah.
It's just, I was at the fancy food show last week, and the amount of just different types of cheeses and meats and things like that just give you a taste of just how big it is and how special each story people have when it comes to having those, like, this is my grandfather's recipe of handmade cheese, this is the ham we've been carrying for forever. But, you know, it's one thing to be in the Javits Center. It's another thing to go to a farm in Spain.
No, it's true. And I think, you know, you hear a lot of people say that, you know, I mean, there's nothing like being in a place eating the local food or, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing about, you know, when you think about the whole local thing, we think, okay, local means, you know, we're going to, you know, let me just say food sets up this sort of double standard because we there's this urban culture that is just fanatical about like where the tomato came from.
Yeah.
But then they forget that half the stuff they wear is also an agricultural product. They don't give a, you know, they don't care where it comes from.
No.
So.
But there's also some point, and I think there was a turning point in my obsession with food and that sort of fanaticism. I remember reading this Times article about, it was about fanaticism and about people going out to like Sheepshead Bay or something like that and to find this special type of fish. And there was some loss of joy and some just like where just was so much about like, I have to get this product because I have to get this product. Not because it was anything that was something that they may have enjoyed. And maybe they did enjoy it, but it was more about like having it to say that you had it. Where I think it is that double-edged of sort of food culture where you go, well, is it really that good? Do you really care about it? Or are you just trying to add another thing to your checklist of things that you had and that you ate?
Well, I think what you're talking about is there's been a massive shift in our culture surrounding food. I mean, first of all, local food, I think it's important to honor local food. Because, you know, and that means, you know, when you're in a place, you're really going to connect culturally. I mean, the local food movement a lot of times is talked about an environmental thing, but, you know, it's a cultural thing. And it's just a deep way of connecting with a local culture. And there's nothing like, you know, sitting in southern Spain, drinking a great sherry and eating in, you know, eating Iberian ham. I mean, there is that. But it does, you know, food culture has bred a lot of fanaticism. I actually did a TED talk about, in TEDx Portland talk about 2 months ago. And the theme of it was how food has become almost like religion. You know, and I actually related to this because, you know, I'm not a religious person at this point, but I was raised a Jehovah's Witness.
Really?
Yeah. Little known fact.
There we go.
Not that anyone cares, but little known fact. But one of the things I learned, you know, that was that culture is very multiracial, and that's why I was exposed to all that great food. And, you know, one thing I can say is like it's a very integrated community. But, you know, you would hear people talk about, you know, religion in a way, and, you know, they would say, oh, you have to do this because here's why. And it's, you know, based on something that, you know, somebody else with a differing opinion would object to. And food's almost become the same way. You know, you talk about vegans or, you know, people who are advocating for only a plant-based diet, and they have all the science and literature to back it up. In the same way any religion member has right. all the scripture to back it up. And right. then you have, you know, the folks who are like, okay, you know, we advocate a paleo diet, and here's our list of experts. So it's almost like food is evolving into this, like, you have all these different religious groups, you hang out with your own little group,
yeah.
you vehemently disagree with people, you know, and I think, you know, that's fine. As long as people are interested in food, it's great to be passionate, but I think we cannot lose sight of the most important piece, which is this great power of food to bring people together.
This special program has been brought to you by TechServe. TechServe is presenting a series of workshops for girls interested in science, technology, engineering, and math topics, open to girls ages 13 to 16.
Hey girls, even if it feels like you don't have enough experience to create a resume, you're going to need one to land your first job or internship. Learn how to turn your achievements at school, summer camp, or volunteering into a resume with TechServe. On July 27th, 2013, join TechServe to learn about the ins and outs of resume writing. Find out how to write about your accomplishments, how to find entry-level jobs and internships, and so much more.
The workshop will be held at TechServe's retail store in Chelsea at 119 West 23rd Street. Admission is on a pay-what-you-can basis, with all proceeds going to the Lower East Side Girls Club.
TechServe. Make stuff happen.
When did you start shifting from being someone who loved food to seeing food as an event and as a career, as a lifestyle for you?
Okay, so I moved to Spain. I was working, you know, during my 20s, I did a lot of things. I wrote for some tech magazines and television stations and, like, worked in commercial real estate. And
were you traveling a lot?
I traveled, yeah. I was like, one of those kids. I lived in, like, Ireland for a year, and I lived in D.C. for a year, and I lived in, you know, I lived in San Francisco for a year. And then I landed in Portland. This was, like, when the real estate boom was hot. Bought a house at age 26. And the market was out of control. And, you know, my wife and I one day, this was like when I was 28, we were like, you know, we could stay in our house and trade it in for a bigger house, or we could sell it and go live abroad. So that's what we did.
Amazing.
We sold our house, quit our jobs, and moved to Spain. And, you know, we lived in Madrid for a year.
As one does.
As one does.
As one does.
And then, you know, the nice, I mean, not nice for
why
others.
Why did you pick Madrid?
I've always felt this connection to Spain. I don't know why. Yeah, I've always wanted to be in Spain, and I think probably because, you know, in retrospect, Spain's a country that you could really live incredibly well for not a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, Madrid is great. I love the Mercado San Miguel.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's amazing. Oysters, the biggest oysters I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of food culture. I mean, it's a great food city.
Oh, it's an amazing food city. And, you know, Madrid is also a city that is less on the radar. I mean, everyone talks about Spain, mm-hmm. and they talk about Barcelona, which is a great city.
But Barcelona's a fun party. We're going to go hang out till sunrise.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, Madrid is that too. But, yeah. you know, I would say, you know, Madrid is a Spanish city. Barcelona is in Catalonia. It's a different culture. I mean, yeah, it's influenced by Spain, but people from Barcelona are Catalan. They don't, I mean,
right.
Spanish is not their first language.
Right, right, right.
You know, so it's a different thing. It's not, so, you know, Spain is, you know, when you go to Madrid, you're talking about a place that's like the heart of Castilla. You know, it's the heart of Spanish culture. It's a very different place. And this is where, you know, they have a saying there. It's translates, you know, it's what is it? Anyway, it's a weather statement that says, you know, 8 months of winter and 4 months of hell. And essentially what it creates because of the extreme weather conditions are all these great cured meats and great cured mm-hmm. cheeses and, you know, a cuisine that's representative of that. And I think in Madrid, living around that, I mean, everyone identified with food as part of who they were. It wasn't like, you know, the States has its own food culture going, but Madrid, it was a little different. It was like you would ask someone, for example, what place has the best Spanish tortilla? And they would say, my mom.
Right.
My mom makes the best Spanish tortilla. And the whole point of that is, well, you know, we might say the same thing about some of our mom's cooking too. But the point was, this Spanish tortilla that I grew up with is part of who I am.
Right. So they're identified by the dishes that that are – it's part of who they are.
And there's one place in America like that.
Where?
Texas. Barbecue in Hill Country.
Right.
It's like – I mean, there's probably other places, but
– Well, the Jewish culture.
Okay.
And the like Chinese culture as well. If you ask somebody who's where can I go for the best fill-in Jewish cuisine, Chinese cuisine, they're going to say my mother.
Yeah, I agree. I think what I mean is as a geographical region, though.
Absolutely.
You know, you go to Texas.
Hey, it's not our fault that we had the diaspora happen to us.
No, it's true. Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, with Unique Eats, we did a segment on Franklin Barbecue.
Love it.
It's incredible.
Shout out to Aaron.
Yeah, shout out to Aaron, one of the greatest people in the food world. And his barbecue is incredible. But I remember, you know, I was in Texas. I was used to run their food or help run their food festival down there. And I was flying. I came into Texas and I tried a bunch of places for Unique Eats. And I was leaving the next day to New York City. And I was talking to this woman, Beth Pav, who's in the food world. I'll never forget this. She's from Hill Country. And she said, "What do you?" I told her we were doing an episode on barbecue. She's like, "Well, what do you know about barbecue?" And, you know, of course, I replied with what any, you know, smug, erudite food writer, "Oh, well, slow and low, post oak, Hill Country, right. Texas." You know, I started giving, and she said, "Okay, then let me ask you this. What's the best barbecue in Texas?" And, of course, you know, like anybody who's read the list, "Oh, well, Franklin, Snow's," and you go down the list. She's like, "No, it's what you grew up with."
Right.
And
yeah, and that's a culture where everybody's mom or dad or grandfather, grandmother – has a smoker, and barbecue's a point of pride, but it's just it's cooked into their existence. But that's also one of the few places where you can really look at an area and say, this is the regional cuisine. This is, you can look at Texas and say, this is barbecue, this is cuisine. I guess North Carolina a little bit, or like, it's or maybe different. Memphis, but it's different.
It's different. It's and different. It's not to take anything away from it. I mean, a friend of mine who wrote an article in a national publication proclaiming Franklin Barbecue the best in America. You know, they ended up getting all these calls from Kansas City.
Of course.
You know, I mean, people, that is a point of, you know, that's like, I mean, that's like arguing over where's the center of Christianity, you know?
It was, there's a show on the air right now called BBQ Pitmasters, and Aaron was actually a guest judge on a recent episode, and they had a barbecue pitmaster from Georgia, and I guess one of the judges is from Georgia as well, and they were talking about all this pride of Georgian barbecue, which I'm sure exists.
Yep.
That being said, up until I watched that episode this weekend, I had no idea that Georgia was really known for its barbecue.
No, and I nor had I, but you know, it makes me want to go to Georgia's.
Yeah, no, because Georgia. First off, Atlanta. I think Georgia's going to really emerge as a huge culinary scene.
Well, yeah,
it's got the agriculture. It's got Atlanta. It's cheap in a way that you can afford to do a sort of grandiose restaurant or just sort of have a niche type of restaurant. But the idea of someone saying, "Where's the best barbecue in America?" and someone saying, "Georgia," I was like, what are you even talking about?
Well, best is such a funny word, though, to use for anything.
I mean, best is relative in the food world.
But it, you know, let's be honest, though. I mean, I worked as a – I was a – you know, quickly going back to my story.
Yes.
I worked as a summer after living in Madrid for a year. I worked on organic farms in Spain and Portugal for a summer and came back and was sort of like – I always thought of food as my passion. But
no, wait. Was this when you sold your house or this is before?
This is after I – so I sold my house. We moved to Spain.
Yeah.
We did a lot of things. Like we did a lot of crazy – we took a train across America, went to Switzerland for a month.
How was the train across America?
It was awesome. But the key to the train across America is you don't do it direct. Like we went from Seattle – got out in Glacier National Park.
Right.
Got back on. The hardest stretches between Glacier and Minneapolis. Hung out in Minneapolis, which, by the way, is a great food city.
Great food city. We had one of the Sessman brothers on here who used to work at Zingerman's.
Yeah, great food city, great design city. You know, I mean, really good graphic design, good art city, good public art. Minneapolis is a great city that people don't often talk about enough. Went to Chicago, another great city with good public art.
Amazing.
And then went to Pittsburgh. And then
they have good art too.
I haven't been there in about. It's been a while since I've been there.
They have well, the Warhol Museum is there,
of course. Yeah.
And then you know, when you have two large universities, you're going to get sort of that creative collegiate. Even though it's Pitt and Carnegie Mellon, you still get that collegiate artsy thing going on.
Sure. And Pittsburgh is also blessed with a lot of, you know, interesting topography and good building stock, you know, and I think it's having this resurgence right now because of that.
They have a couple of Frank Lloyd Wright houses there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, well, I think Falling Water is not too far. Anyway,
so you're going across.
So we go to New York, and then we took a road trip to the south and back, and then flew to Switzerland, hung out there for a while, went around Spain and Germany and France, accidentally went to Lyon and didn't know it was the gastronomic capital of France. It just blew my mind.
Oh, you just wound up there.
Yeah, it was actually funny. There was a flood in Switzerland. It was the same week as Hurricane Katrina, too.
Okay.
And it was, I have to say, pretty terrible watching on TV the utter chaos of the response system in the U.S. and then watching, you know, the Swiss, all of Lucerne was under 4 feet of water. And 3 days in advance, they built this incredible, you know, raised, you know, system and like sandbagged the whole city. The only fatality was a cow. Granted, it wasn't on the magnitude of Katrina, but it was still like, geez, these people really have it together in Switzerland.
They talk about that part of the world having those plans for those type of 100-year storms and planning on saying like, well, this is what's going to happen because of the way that they built their city. So close to the water and how water is a part of their makeup.
No, it's true. And it's also, you know, Switzerland is a, you know, you're talking about the people who invented insurance and the modern watch. This is an organized society.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had planned to go down to Florence, and for the first time in like 40 years, the train tracks washed out, so we ended up going to Lyon. And it was totally mind-blowing. But, you know, lived in Madrid for a year and then spent a summer on organic farms, came back and was about to turn, you know, 30 and was like, geez, what am I going to do with my life? I've had some good experience, but I've always thought of food as my passion and not, you know, like it's separate. I just realized I needed to make this into what I did. And I, you know, became an intern at a Alt Weekly and then quickly became the food writer / critic. And then I, you know, went up to the Portland Monthly Magazine. My gigs got better, but I started consulting on events on the side. And for me, I found you could tell a story with an event. Like if you wanted to show people like, you know, that's the key. Like people who really do events well. I mean, if you just want to do an event, you may as well plan a damn wedding. Like if you just want to do like,
but that's what people do.
Yeah, and that's what most people do.
And, you know, it's funny you bring that up.
Yeah,
and I hate to interrupt, but the wedding thing. I'm an events guy.
Yeah,
you're an events guy. A lot of my friends, I'm sure your friends are events guys. And when you see people spend $40,000 or $50,000 on a wedding, on one hand, I get it. Like this is one of.
Sure.
The only sanctioned times in their life where it's like you get to plan an event, curate the guest list, the music, the food. Like this is your day.
Right.
This is your big public coming out thing. And from everyone I talk to in food and events, you go, yeah, it's not. I don't know. There's just a checklist, and it's like not that crazy. And just like the idea of spending $50,000 or $60,000 on a wedding seems a little ridiculous at some point. It's that balance of being like, how can we do it where it's or it's like. Then spending $50,000 or $60,000 and then having just like this very mediocre event.
Well, people do that like in everything in life. They don't ask a question. No one thinks critically about anything. They're like, how do I make my wedding better? The reality is at a wedding, let's just be honest about something at a wedding. Most people are bored by the ceremony, so make it quick.
Very quick.
No one gives a damn about watching you cut the cake. I'm sorry. No one cares.
No one cares. Like by the time dessert is coming out. It's just like, just have it come out.
Right.
Like dessert, people by the time people are drunk and they want to dance and they've been eyeing that groomsman or that bridesmaid, like they don't want to sit there and be like two hands on a knife. Like,
doesn't matter. Same thing with the first dance, all that. I mean, maybe somebody cares, but most people don't. If you want to make your wedding reception memorable, throw a really good party. And it's the same thing about a food event. Like,
absolutely.
Like make it fun. Make, you know, on the side of making, you know, making a great event, it's like make sure your lines are short. Don't run out of food. Don't run out of booze. Don't run out of beer. And make sure everyone from the chef to the volunteers has a blast.
Everyone. I mean, really, that's what people as food events become more and more popular.
Yeah.
And you see more and more people. And I know that I think you and I have the same experience where people start reaching out to you saying like, oh, how do you put on a food event? How do you do this? This is what I want to do. And right off the bat, you go, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Like, and the thing is, though, people get.
I don't even tell them that anymore.
You know,
it's like good luck.
Yeah. There was.
It's not.
I won't say the specifics because I'll get specific. But I met with someone recently, and they said it was. They're like, we want to do an event where we have, I think, I mean, it was crazy. Something like maybe like 1,500 people show up, or, yeah. or maybe it's, or 1,000, and we want everyone to come at the same time, and there's just like one line of food. And I just and I was like, do you hear yourself? Like, even if you can get people through the line at 10 seconds a person, that's like hours of waiting.
Well, they tried that in the Soviet Union in the 80s.
Yeah, they're called bread lines.
They're called bread lines.
So you're working your way up in Portland, you're writing, and you're starting to see that the story that can be told through an event is, I mean, it's a moment. I mean, I think that's why I like events, and you bring up a good point, is that you were either there or you weren't. It wasn't some book that you could pick up like a couple weeks later. It's like the event was just happening.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, I think, you know, I was doing events in Portland, and then I did, ISCP came to town, and I you know, helped. It was the host city chair and curated a bunch of great events. And then after that, I started doing events nationally. And, you know, for me, it was always what excited me was you know, telling a story and also trying to do things where people come to an event and actually learn things, like where people make a discovery at an event. You know, I'm not so interested, like with Feast, the event we do in Portland with Bon Appetit and Travel Oregon, we really try to do stuff that's like not out of the box. I mean, if you look at a lot of food events around the country right now, there are a lot of them, the majority of them kind of go in the realm of, you know, let's get a bunch of celebrity chefs and, you know, and there's nothing against that. As long as, again, anything that brings people together around food is great. But, you know, I think with like a lot of the chefs that come to Feast Portland, you know, these are chefs who are driving food culture in America, right. But a lot of them, you know, a lot of people haven't heard of, like, you know,
haven't heard of yet.
Exactly. Exactly.
You want to be able, and I think what I love about Feast is to look back even a year later and go, holy shit, this is the current who's who in America.
Right. And, you know, and I feel the same way, like with the new direction of this is happening overall in the food world right now. I mean, look at the new direction with Bon Appetit magazine. You know, like what?
I just want to say, haven't they mastered the like sliced prep, like greasy, dripping, beautiful food shot?
Amazing.
It's like they are the kings of that.
Sure. But, like, look at, you know, about a year and a half ago, they had an article, you know, they'll do an article on, like, they did an article, didn't they do an article on Magnus Nilsson or, you know, mm-hmm. Rene Redzepi,
yeah.
Which, you know, they did an article on Martin Picard up in Montreal. And I know if you're in the food world, you're thinking, oh, well, I've heard of these people. But these are like the Leonard Cohen figures in the food world.
Oh, absolutely.
These
well,
are not
the,
like.
Let's not forget Bon App cleaned house like two and a half years ago. They have a new direction.
Sure.
But that's the way it is. And I think. It's that balance, too, because you know, as great it would be to have, like, a Martin Picard
mm-hmm.
come to, like, a feast, it's also great to have the new guy as well.
No, it's true. And that's, we always, when Carrie Walsh and I, who's the co-founder of Feast, you know, she was instrumental in helping, she was head of PR at Food Network when they started the New York City Wine and Food Festival, and she was really instrumental in getting that event off the ground. And, you know, when we talked about starting an event in Portland, we deliberately wanted to do something that was a little different. And we made the comparison of doing something like a South by Southwest of food. And what that meant was we wanted to kind of have a nice mix of people who were really well known, but also a mix of up and comers, you know, and that's what we really did. So, like, last year we had, you know, folks like, some great chefs out there. You know, Sean Brock came out and did a dinner, and, you know, Gabrielle Hamilton was there doing a dinner. But then, thanks to our friends at Bon Appetit, you know, Fergus Henderson came.
Amazing.
And was walking around. And, you know, it's interesting. In other words, Adam Rappaport, when he was saying Fergus wanted to come, and Bon Appetit actually brought him out. He's like, you know, to a lot of these young chefs, this guy's like Bob Dylan, which is exactly what he said. He's right, you know. And the most talked about person around town in Portland that weekend was Fergus Henderson. And then young chefs got to meet him. I mean, this guy's like a hero to them.
It's amazing. And it's amazing being that connector.
Yeah.
So when did you – so you're back from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
You go back to Portland, right?
Yep.
So you're in Portland. You're working your way up. What was the first event you threw?
First event I did was, it was sort of lame thinking about it now, was at a condo in Portland as an attempt to pair coffee and chocolate, you know, and it
Why
was
is it lame?
Because I tried to do too much. And that's anytime you try to do too much in anything, whether you're a restaurant,
yeah.
whether it's an event, it's not going to work. Cause the mm-hmm. takeaway needs to be the way that was fun. And I was exposed to some cool things. But then after that, you know, the two sort of big, well, three big breaks for me, you know, was the first was a woman by the name of Lisa Donahue, who works in the food world and was really connected here in New York and still actually maintains an office here. gave me an opportunity to be the director of the Indy Wine Festival, which is a small, really cool wine festival in Portland. And that was my first event. And, you know, from her, I really learned the ability to be the connector through food events and really saw that, you know, that was just an amazing opportunity for, you know, on one hand, for people who attended to really be exposed to some cool stuff, but also for businesses, you know, be it wineries or sponsors, to really manifest business objectives through events.
Right.
And you know, not only position their brands in certain ways, but also, you know, make strong statements about who they were and you know, make connections. You know, that's one of the beautiful things about any event you do is how well can you connect people on the business side.
It's a tough thing as well, especially I think being in Portland and Brooklyn, and we've talked about it before, and less as you go on, but the concept of selling out, which I think was a very 90s type of concept, sure, or even 80s, where it's, you're like, oh, I can't believe that you have this or that or anything. Well, it's like, no, how do you think this is happening? Someone's got to pay for it.
Yeah.
And we want to do big things, and we don't want the consumer to shoulder the entire cost. And then you find it's up to you as sort of a creative, mm-hmm, to figure out how to execute a brand where it's not, you know, all-consuming the event, or it's not just like this unorganic fit.
Yeah.
What have actually been some of your more creative fits for brands?
Okay, so the first event that I did in New York City in 2010, Lockhart Steel with Eater, who was out in Portland, mm-hmm, at a dinner, essentially he offered me the opportunity to curate the first Eater Awards here in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And I did the first two. And I would say the thing that's so cool about Eater is like, they're like, make it cool. That's the directive. Make it cool. And, you know, year two especially, like year one was all New York chefs and it was incredible. Year two, we had, and this was 2011, we had Franklin Barbecue from Austin.
It was at the Dream, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. We had, you know, Danny from Mission Chinese. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, Thomas McNaughton, Flour and Water. Naomi from Beast came out.
What up, Naomi?
Yeah, and Andy also from Pock Pock came out and did his wings. And we had great New York chefs. Like at the time, we had Red Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dave Arnold was there doing some interesting stuff. It was just this incredible opportunity.
And you had Absolute as a sponsor, if I remember.
Oh, I can't remember who the liquor
was. But I remember.
They took care of the liquors.
Well, I just remember there being really good cocktails with a brand that would not normally grace the bars of certain like cocktail type of dens.
Yeah, I mean, I know that our first Eater Awards was the first Eater Awards was sponsored by Grey Goose. It's been 2 years; I can't remember the second year. But yeah, I mean, they did a great job. It was really fun to work with them, and then also, you know, working on what was formerly the Texas Hill Country Wine and Food Festival, mm-hmm, in Texas, and we created an event called Live Fire, which was, you know, the whole theme was, you know, chef's fire meat cooking over an open flame.
Love it.
And we had, like, you know, chefs like Rene Ortiz of La Condesa in Austin, Brad Farmery from Public came down from New York. We, you know, Andy Ricker came out and did that event. Franklin Barbecue.
Isn't Andy just awesome?
Yeah. Oh, and Franklin Barbecue was at that second Eater Awards too. And the night ended, I remember there's all these photos of, you know, people in front of the after party, you know, standing in front of the bar we were at, you know, and Aaron like hand feeding people big chunks of brisket. So
yeah, he's good like that.
Sort of like, you know, sacrament.
It's really, it's when you see him with some like wax paper and it's greasy, just get close.
Yeah, just get close.
Just get close.
Get cozy.
So now you've been doing all these events. Can I ask what, and you don't have to name the specific event, what the worst moment in events was for you?
For me?
We always like to try.
Okay.
Like, you know, just like.
No, I can do that.
What was that like? What am I doing?
Okay, so this is an important lesson. And this happens in every, you know, moment where you kind of get to the point in your career where you realize, a friend of mine calls it the kill the father moment. When you realize you're kind of on your own and you don't. There was an event that I was working for, and I won't say where or when, but I had brought in all these. I was working as a kind of a sponsorship guy, and I brought in all these sponsors. And, you know, it became very clear the day of this event that there wasn't quite the production know-how to execute in the proper way. And I remember just standing there looking at it with one very upset sponsor, being kind of upset, but also thinking like, okay, I'm done doing stuff that's hard.
Yeah.
And we've all been there.
I think we've all been there. I think you look at something and you go,
yeah,
why isn't this working?
Yeah.
And is it on me?
Sure.
Or is it who I'm working with, right, or the way I'm approaching it?
Yeah. Well, then you get to a point in your career, you know, where you get, you know, I'm very lucky. I mean, I get to work with, at this point, you know, everyone I work with, I enjoy working with. I mean, the Feast team's incredible. You know, I do a lot of work with Whole Foods Market. I work with other brands, and, you know, I consult on other festivals, and, you know, I think the takeaway from that was, you know, you just have to surround yourself with good people no matter what you do, because,
absolutely,
you know, if you're passionate about something, you know, and it's like why you get out of bed in the morning, then you cannot, you got to make sure you're around people who feel the same way. Otherwise, you just sell yourself short.
And the thing about events is that it's all about human interaction. There's no,
sure,
newspaper or radio station or TV show to hide behind it, and there's no editing. It is what it is. And for as long as my brother and I have been doing events, we've always said, you better like who you're working with,
yep,
from the bouncer at the door.
Yep.
Because what people don't really understand is that the guy checking IDs, he's usually the first point of contact,
sure,
for the night.
Why do you think that, you know, when you go to a really well put together restaurant, the hostess stand, that can make a break.
Oh my God.
The restaurant experience.
We were just upstate over the weekend in northern New York, and, you know, you just start to understand what really good service and really good hosting and really good, and what it comes down to is hiring. Because look, in the event world or even the food world, stuff is going to happen. It's,
yeah,
out of control, and it's all on how you handle it.
Sure.
And sometimes you're going to be at an event that you're putting on where you just go, I'm really sorry, this is out of my hands.
Well, the key part of that, though, and this is why food is so different than like a music event.
Absolutely.
And this is funny because we're in this realm right now where a lot of music producers are hopping on the food event world.
They do not understand it.
Well, the thing that you know, so maybe some of them will or do eventually, but the thing that people forget is, you know, the food world is pretty small, and even chefs that are really famous still know oftentimes the people who grow their food. You know, that's one thing. So it's like this really important community. So I think you got to come in and, you know, really try to do your best to take care of everyone, you know, and not, you can't come in and be too pushy or elitist. You just can't. It won't work.
Here's the, I think one of the best things, and I wish I could remember who really explains out to me, that, someone who also had a foot in food and music world. And they go, what a lot of these music people don't understand is that with a band, one act of entertainment,
yep,
can engage with 100,000 people,
right,
at a time. With food, it's a one-on-one experience.
No, it's true.
Even if you have 3 points of sales,
yeah,
or 4 points of sale, you can't get through 100,000 people with food the way you can with music. And it's a really delicate approach because you want to be able to, obviously, and I know everyone hates saying this about events, but you got some point, you want to make a profit, have it be, especially if you want it to be a career, you got to be able to make money off of it. But at the same time, you don't want to make it so it's just so uncontrollably stuffed with people that it's a miserable experience.
Well, it's got to be a good experience, you know, for everybody. I mean, with Feast, you know, one of the things we do is, you know, we donate our net profits to charity. So, you
amazing,
know, which last year, in our first year, we donated $48,000, which for a first year event, I mean, we know
that's huge.
It's hard.
You're lucky to break even on a first year,
yeah,
event.
Yeah. Well, we have an incredible team, and this year we're definitely on track to top that. But you know, you really have to make sure, like, you just have to think about the comparison to food and music too. It's like, you know, unless you're Jesus Christ on the Sermon on the Mount, you're not going to be able to feed the multitudes of people with a little amount of food. I mean, the thing,
and even then, I think he had some like a good wait staff.
Yeah, there you go. He had excellent front of house.
Excellent front of house.
Yeah.
Just, it's going to be a few more minutes. We got to turn a few more loaves of bread.
Totally.
A few more fishes. Just pass it around.
It was kind of like the Olive Garden.
We got some manna
kept
coming out. Yeah, yeah, unlimited manna, unlimited breadsticks.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, manna. Going Old Testament on
very Old Testament. Yeah,
yeah. Well, you know, with. You know, with like a music festival, you put, you know, Radiohead on the stage, and you're right, 100,000 people are happy. The amount of background and logistics it takes, even for an event of 1,000 people, to make sure that, you know, the lines aren't too long. I mean, the amount you have to invest in that, the amount you have, I couldn't do it personally. I have to say, you know, I have an amazing director of events for Feast named Emily Crowley, who literally is the reason why Feast goes off pretty much without a hiccup. But you need those people who are like, you know, who are kind of like completely hospitable and take care of people, but also have the brain of like an air traffic controller.
Well, and also who knows how to say, I can't deal with you right now in a nice way, or in a not so nice way.
Sure.
Let's talk about Feast.
Uh-huh.
Second year. So you've been doing these events and this consulting like that. How did Feast come to exist?
Well, I think it was a couple things. After IACP, International Association of Culinary Professionals, was in Portland for its annual conference in 2010, I was the guy in charge of the, you know, organizing mm-hmm. that conference. You know, and there was, it was a special moment in Portland food. I think, you know, there was, you know, Ruth Reichel came out and Michael Ruhlman came out and Judith Jones and Mater Jaffray and kind of all these like legendary food people, plus all this media. And it was really fun to play host, you know. So that was at that moment. After that, it was like the seed was planted to like, wow, I think, you know, Portland should have an opportunity to play host every year. That was one thing. That was kind of what planted the seed. And, you know, then I was kind of fishing the idea out there. And, you know, I think all the tourism boards like Travel Oregon, Travel Portland, they were all on board with it. And a lot of the folks we worked with. But it really wasn't until I met Kerry Walsh, who was fresh off the boat from New York City, that the plan really solidified. She came here, and one of the first things she asked me is, when is the festival? And I'm like, well, there really isn't one, but, you know, there needs to be.
Right.
And she and I just immediately jumped on it. And, you know, Travel Oregon got behind us, you know, because Oregon really promotes itself heavily on food, as it should. I mean, it's not just about Portland. It's about that, you know, we grow more hops than any state in the country. Oregon is a huge export state for agricultural products. You know, we're the third largest wine producing state. We have over 400 wineries and a lot of damn good ones. We have, you know, forefront of beer culture, forefront of coffee culture. You know, it's just, you know, and then the chef piece is just because of all those things, you know. So we really felt it was a great place to have an event, and so did all these other organizations. And Kerry and I just went out and, you know, we worked and got a lot of folks on board. Bon Appetit got on pretty early with us.
Amazing.
You know, there was a lot of personal connections, you know, there's there as well as, you know, an affinity. There was a lot of friendships and a lot of, you know, a couple of folks like Kalu Henry, who works in events over at Bon Appetit, had, you know, lived in Portland for a while and worked in the wine industry and actually taught me more about Oregon wines than I knew. And I'm a native, you know, so there was this like affinity. And, you know, we were able to build something that turned into a 4-day event with about 45 different events. We had dinners, we had, you know, chefs from all over the place, you know, and this year is year two. I mean, we're doing an Asian night market that, you know, Latin/Asian night market, but this year it's more in the realm of street food. We have, like, you know, Michael Solomonoff mm-hmm. from Philadelphia, and, you know, Hugh Akison from the South, and Chris Cosentino and Danny from Mission Chinese, and plus all the great Portland chefs like, you know, Andy Ricker, and, you know, a whole lot more. We're doing an event called High Comfort that's essentially like comfort food pushed out of the comfort zone. So it's like, you know, crazy, awesome, over-the-top comfort food. And, you know, chefs like from New York, Andrew Carmelini's coming, and April Bloomfield's coming, you know, on top of Chef Matt Leitner from Aterra here in New York.
He's a boy.
Yeah, he's a good friend. And I just have to say, we talked about this before, like, you know, I don't plug chefs because they're my friends, because there's a lot of chefs I'm friends with who I don't plug, but God damn, his food is incredible.
He at the Sheriff's Drink thing, he did this. It looked like a macaroon, but it was like this take on caviar.
Yeah.
That dish. It's just one of the things where I go, how do I eat four more without looking like I'm just shoveling in my face?
It's pretty. It's definitely really, really great. But, you know, the thing, too, is we wanted to do a little different with Feast was 70% of our lineup is local. Like, it's all these Oregon chefs and Portland chefs, and every damn beer you drink at Feast is from Oregon, and every wine is from the Pacific Northwest. And that's where, like, if you look at, you know, the way a lot of the food festivals, I mean, there's food festivals popping up in places
everywhere,
but places known for specific products, you know, and
do you want to shout out a city?
What?
Do you want to name a city?
Oh, I shouldn't do that.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, you know, I think events that are going to have longevity are going to be a, you know, mix. You know, we have national sponsors. We work with, you know, and you need that network. But I think it's important to showcase the local industries. And I think festivals with longevities, you know, because I don't want to go to, you know, the equivalent of like going to Spain and drinking French wine. I want to go to France and drink, you know, French wine. And
And it's a lot like these music festivals where now, especially, I mean, Europe is one thing because it's all these different countries, but there is definitely like we're going from, you know, east to west,
right,
June through August with that. But if you start looking at food festivals in America, you start seeing the same like five or ten names pop up, and it is sort of like these headliners, but look, they're coming in maybe for the day.
Yeah.
They're not invested. They're not – maybe they're using local products, but it's just – it's not the same. I mean, sort of like you feel – you don't feel that you really experienced anything. You didn't learn anything about the city because you could be in, you know, North Carolina, or you could be in Wyoming, or you could be in Kansas, because they're just saying like, oh, we're doing a food festival.
Yeah. Well, we have 82 chefs this year at Feast, and 75% of them are from Portland and Oregon.
Wow.
And a lot of people say, well, you're doing an event in Portland. Why have any chefs from out of – well, because it's really important. It's like bring chefs – first of all, just the community and the camaraderie. Everyone in whatever industry they're in, they like to interact with people who do the same thing. I mean, you and I get along because we both do events. You know, and I remember the first time I met you, we talked events for like an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and that level of camaraderie – that's why a lot of chefs like doing these events.
Yeah.
And, you know, we wanted an excuse to not only bring out – I mean, this is a big tourism play for us too. You know, our economy in Oregon is based so heavily on food, and we want people to come out every year and enjoy it. And we want people who are cooks and people who are media to come out and, you know, experience what Portland and Oregon is all about and then come back and tell people about it, or come back and cook with our – you know, every protein at Feast is from the Pacific Northwest.
So awesome. I love the Ollie's from Olympia, the oysters.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I could eat buckets.
It's the Northwest is a special place. You know, this year, too, we have a lot of Seattle chefs.
That's great.
Seattle's a good city for food. We have, you know, like Renee Erickson from Wallace on the Carpenter, Tom Douglas.
I know. I will admit, on air, I know about the Portland scene. I know very little about the Seattle scene.
Yeah, Seattle is one of those cities because I think it hasn't gotten as much cred. It's probably the most underrated food city. I mean, it's everyone knows the food is good, but I think Seattle is known for so many other things too.
Yeah, but it's also sort of like the way that Philadelphia
Philly.
I mean, I'm a Philly boy, and you know, we're bringing Mark and Brad up tomorrow for the barbecue. Like, I got Philly pride.
Can we talk Philly?
We can talk Philly, but to make my analogy is that Philly is in the way that Seattle is. Yeah. That like it sits so close to Portland. Yeah. In the same way that Philly sat close to New York for so years, that it's going to get its due.
Sure. Well, but here's the thing to remember, though. Portland, for years, didn't get its due. Seattle was the big city in the Pacific Northwest. It is the big city in the Pacific Northwest. It's you know, it's funny. People say, is there a rivalry? Not really. Because, like, it's kind of like...
It's apples and oranges.
Or yeah, it's
apples and CDs. Or grunge records. There
you
go.
You know, yeah. I think the way... The comparison that I think is best is... You know, it's almost like Seattle versus Portland is almost like Manhattan versus Brooklyn. Outsiders think it's silly. Like, I think the whole Manhattan versus Brooklyn thing is silly because both – but I have nothing vested in it.
Nothing invested. I think it's one of those things, though, that it's funny. Growing up, when music played a bigger role in my life, I never thought twice about Portland. It was always Seattle. Now that food is the dominant thing in my life, I rarely think about Seattle. When I think Northwest – Portland.
Well, I mean, and I think that's a lot of times the case. But like, let's and with music. But here's the thing with music. And I remember going to high school, and there was these great bands, like, you know, Greg Sage and the Wipers from Portland, Dead Moon, that were these legendary bands that, like, you know, I guess you could say they were like the. I'm trying to think of a good analogy. I mean, I guess you could say, you know, the Melvins. It's like, oh gosh, what's the name of that crazy deli in the Lower East Side that Shopson's? Yeah, it's like, I guess he's like the Melvins of New York food.
Tom Shopson.
But you know, you have like this, Seattle is a city that is known for so many things. Seattle is a big international city. It's about, you know, probably 75% larger than Portland. It has Boeing, it has Microsoft, it has a, you know, thriving, you know, Portland has a very thriving startup scene right now, but Seattle's known for many things. It had the whole grunge thing. The whole Portland food, I think, Portland got really well known for food for a lot of reasons, but, you know, part of it was the whole country in this sort of down economy was obsessed with the type of stuff Portland already did.
Right.
It was obsessed with pickling. It was obsessed with DIY. It was at a time when, you know, in 2008 or 2007, not to say we didn't have a food reputation before that, but it really took off then. You know, it wasn't sexy to talk about the most expensive restaurant in Vegas. No one cared about the $35 entree. Life, you know, the whole story, whether you were talking about, you know, real estate or wine or food, became all of a sudden all about quality of life and not luxury, and no place personified that more than Portland. Now that the economy's coming back, things are kind of getting, you know, a little more luxe again. But, you know, and I think, you know, that changes the narrative, but I think Portland's done a good job at establishing itself. But, you know, in Seattle, there's amazing
food. With no little help. You helped as well.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people that have helped. I always think it's funny when, you know, people take credit. You know, I mean, before me, there's been years, you know, James Beard was from Portland. There's been years and years of people, but, you know, nobody is more responsible for Portland having a food reputation than all the great chefs.
Absolutely.
And not just the ones you've heard up now. I mean, before Naomi Pomeroy and Andy Ricker and Gabe Rucker, there were guys like Greg Higgins and, you know, Corey Schreiber. I mean, it's gone back a long ways. You know, all the great farmers, all the great winemakers, all the great brewers, you know, and to be honest, the tourism industry out there that really does a good job in promoting the right things.
Yeah, which is tough, which is very tough.
Yeah.
It's very tough. What did you want to say about Philly?
Well, I finished the thought real quick. Seattle's a great place to
eat.
Walrus and Carpenter right now is one of my favorite restaurants of anywhere on the planet. And
are they going to be at Feast?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, Canlis is an incredible restaurant. Jason Franey's a brilliant chef. You know, Seattle has this sort of new kind of... You know, for a long time, I sort of always thought Seattle had a good food scene, but like you didn't go there and you say, oh, there's a certain thing. It's kind of like a bunch of good restaurants. With like this really interesting kind of neo-bistro thing happening there. There's like you know, chefs like there's a chef there named Matt Dillon who won the James Beard Award last year. He opened a place, I think it's called Bar Sojour. It's in Pioneer Square, and it's like there's all these – they're kind of bistro. They're kind of minimal. They almost feel like the type of restaurant you find in, like, you know, a Scandinavian country.
Mm-hmm.
But they're heavy on the fish. They're heavy on really interesting bread programs. Walrus and Carpenter's like that. So there's definitely this thing happening in Seattle right now that's really interesting that I think people are really starting to notice. But Seattle is, as is Portland, Seattle is also a fantastic food city.
I feel like my list of things to do on the West Coast is getting like longer and longer.
And you need to go to Vancouver, BC, too.
I've been to Vancouver.
Yeah.
My brother and I did, in our youth, a drive from Boston up to Montreal to Vancouver.
Oh, wow. That's a long drive.
Down to Seattle. It was great. But yeah, the toughest leg is, like you said, the toughest leg is right in the middle. There's nothing.
No, there's nothing.
I mean, you want to talk about – this was 2002. There's nothing in the middle of Canada at that point.
Canola fields.
Not even that. I mean, literally not even like the big hay ball. Like nothing.
Nothing.
Well, I think we're out of time, which is unfortunate because there's so much more we could talk about.
Was that the whole hour?
That was an hour. I didn't even play any music.
Well, do we have time to talk Philly?
Yes, we have time to talk Philly, and then I have one last question for you before we...
So Unique Eats, Irene sent me to Philly for Unique Eats this year, and I was blown away.
It's amazing. I grew up in Philadelphia, and... I mean, I have my love of food from my mother and my grandmother, but I left in 2000 to go to college, and I never went. I didn't move back, and I was away for a few years. And every time I come back to Philly, you know, it was no longer just us going down to Chinatown, which is, by the way, Philadelphia Chinatown is fantastic. But it was like, oh wow, there's actual like restaurants that are really good that I want to eat at, and there are names coming out of Philly that just wasn't Budokan and things like that.
Yeah,
like when I thought of Philadelphia growing up. It was Lebec Fin. And Lebec Fin was like this unattainable restaurant and the Four Seasons in Philadelphia, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But now it's got its own independent voice, its own culture. It's not New York's little brother. It's Philadelphia.
Well, it was like, you know, Peter Sipperco and there's, you know, the Vetri restaurants. Brad Spence from, you know, your boy who's coming in tomorrow.
I'm excited.
I mean, not only just such great food at Amis, but also just such a nice guy.
At Philadelphia.
Michael Solomonoff. The guy is heart of gold.
His pop-up at the Sambar was insane. We went to the industry tasting.
He's coming to Feast.
I can't wait. He did this lamb shoulder on Persian rice that we were eating at 3 in the morning. I got to stop eating because I'm just eating rice with lamb fat, and I know that I'm going to get sick, but I couldn't stop eating it. But Philly also has this... Very like blue collar, salt of the earth, working city. Yeah.
Tripe sandwiches.
Yeah, culture with, you know, Scrapple and all that stuff. And
it's a cool city.
It's a cool city. Home of the pizza museum as yeah. well. Which is like 1,000 different like pizza tchotchkes and things like that. So I love Philly. I'll put it this way. It's if you can make it down, you can eat and drink the entire weekend, and you would scratch the surface, maybe.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe.
What's your parting question?
Who are the chefs to look for at Feast this year?
Well, I mean, I think you can go into our website and you'll see a lot of names you recognize. But like Chris, whose names I can't pronounce, from Night Plus Market in L.A., that's going to be amazing. I'm excited to have Paul Key back from Austin.
Shout out to Paul. Paul's my boy.
I mean, he's just such an incredible chef who hits it at every level, does the lowbrow thing, does the highbrow thing.
I mean, that's the really amazing thing is to see, mm-hmm. like to eat, to dine with him at, and you talk about amazing Houston dining. Yep. Uchi in Houston is phenomenal.
As is Uchi in Austin. No, Tyson Cole, let me just say this, changed the game in Central Texas.
Changed it.
You know, and Uchi's one of the best restaurants anywhere on the planet.
Anywhere on the planet. People, yeah.
Got to give a shout out to Phil Spear, too, the culinary. I mean, they're just so, desserts.
Phil and I have had some nights. But what haunts me the most in my relationship with Phil is that corn dessert. With the polenta ice cream at Uchiko. Have you ever had it?
No, I haven't had that.
Okay. We'll go to Texas.
We should.
We'll go to Texas.
He's so good. Other chefs, real quick. I mean, a lot of great New York chefs. Danny Bowen from Mission Chinese. Shout Andrew Carmelini. Yeah. April Bloomfield. My good friend Brad Farmery. Of course, Andy Ricker, Gabe Rucker, Naomi Pomeroy, you know, Jen Lewis. I really got to shout out to all the Portland chefs. You're going to come to Feast. You're going to see a lot of names you recognize. But, you know, one of the biggest takeaways was a lot of people will say, you know, the Portland chefs a lot of times are the ones that, you know, they remember the most. Probably that's a home court advantage thing too. But, you know, we really have an amazing food scene in Portland, and it's deep. You know, it's not just the chefs you've heard of. We have 700 food carts.
You got to do some crate digging.
Yeah, and you also have to do your research too, because, you know, a lot of the better restaurants in Portland are on the west side. And on the east side, you know, and they're far out. So you got to do your research.
And you got to make your reservations. Because
a lot of places don't take reservations
I know.
In Portland. But, you know, places to check out right now in Portland, Ava Jean's, which is Dwayne's restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing. Game changer. Joshua McFadden, the chef, who used to be at Franny's in Brooklyn. Ox is an incredible place. You know, there's just so many good places right now. And, you know, Feast is a great excuse to get out there and, you know, check out Portland.
How long would you recommend going out?
You know, this is one of the things that's so funny. People come to Portland and you don't go to Portland for urban culture. New Yorkers will come there and they're like, oh, well, I was bored in 2 days. Well, it's freaking Portland. It's like, go to Portland, enjoy Portland for a couple of days, eat at the good restaurants, rent a bike, but then get out. Like a couple weeks ago, Matt Ducker from Bon App came out and I took him to, down the gorge in, the Columbia Gorge, which is incredible. Like, I always try to make it a point now when New York friends come out, you know, got to get them out of the city.
Absolutely.
So, you know, go to Mount Hood, go to the beach. That's really what the whole story is about, because a lot of times not only is it beautiful, that's where all the food comes from, and that's the reason why, you know, Portland has great food is because we have a state that produces incredible seafood, incredible hops, incredible grapes, good proteins, and, you know, and you just happen to, all this stuff comes from really beautiful places. So I would say, you know, give yourself 3 or 4 days, spend a couple days in Portland, and then, you know, take a side trip to the Columbia River Gorge, side trip to the beach.
Awesome. Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough. Thank you for talking and hanging out with me.
No, it's been fun.
Feastportland.com, September 19th through 22nd. Book now.
Yeah.
Book. That's my recommendation. Book now. I'm definitely coming out. I'm sold. After this, there's no way I'm not coming out. So look for me. There, I'll be stuffing my face somewhere.
He'll be the guy passed out in the corner.
No, I'm pretty good at that stuff because my desire to eat outweighs my desire to drink.
Okay. Well, last year we actually cleaned out the entire town of Fernet. The whole town ran out of Fernet.
Oh, my God. Only in a Portland food festival could you clean out the entire – maybe deep Brooklyn. Anything else you want to add about the event? Anything?
All right. Just look forward to seeing you all out there. And, you know, thanks for having me on today.
Awesome. Well, it was great talking to you, and hopefully next time you're back, we'll have you on again. Just a reminder, tomorrow night, Mark Vetri, Brad Spence from the wonderful Vetri, Amis down in Philadelphia, BBQ Blowout, July.eventbrite.com. Come hang out. You get some Brooklyn Brewery. Get some food. It's going to be great.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.